case number 20-6249, USA versus Michael Johnson II. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Ms. Coffin for the appellant.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Coffin. I'm here today on behalf of Michael Johnson. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time.
Fine.
Thank you. For his run-of-the-mill, nonviolent federal guns and drugs offenses, Mr. Johnson is serving a 300-month term of imprisonment, which today is almost 10 years higher than the top of the advisory guideline range and at the statutory maximum for the drug offenses. In denying his request for a sentence reduction under the First Step Act, the district court relied on its determination that Mr. Johnson presents a serious risk of violent reoffending. This is despite the fact that his guideline range already accounts for his risk of reoffending, and despite that he spent the last 18 years in prison working hard to rehabilitate himself with evident success. In his briefing, Mr. Johnson outlines a number of ways that the court's denial of his request presents a procedural unreasonable and substantively unreasonable sentence or outcome. This is an enormous upward variance that the district court gave reasons that are pretty much speculative and based on assumptions about his risk of reoffending.
Well, it's not an enormous upward variance from the actual guideline range we're supposed to look at, right? I mean, you'd like us to look at the current guideline range if he committed these offenses today.
No, I'm asking the court to look at the guideline range that applies as a result of the various retroactive changes, including the one based on the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010.
Well, does that one change his guideline range? It changes the statutory maximum, I think.
It changed his statutory range, but also...
But the guideline range, it didn't change.
The guideline range did change because in the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010, Congress directed the commission to change the guideline ranges, which they did.
Well, what does Maxwell say about this point? Doesn't Maxwell foreclose this argument?
No. Maxwell says that you're supposed to look at the amended guideline range that is based on retroactive changes to the guidelines. I sense, Judge Radler, that you're suggesting that retroactive changes to the guidelines don't apply at the calculation stage, which is a position that the government did not press in this case and has not been accepted by any court.
I thought Maxwell told us to look at the changes. It's not a plenary resentencing. And so we wouldn't look at the current, and maybe I'm wrong with this, but that we wouldn't look at what the current guideline range would be in light of the changes by the Sentencing Commission. But that we can consider the changes that the Fair Sentencing Act made, which I think we both agree would have changed his statutory range or statutory maximum or something along those lines. So
Mr. Johnson's position, which is reflected by thousands of decisions that have happened across the country and many in this circuit, probably hundreds if not thousands in this circuit, is that whatever the amended guideline range, even under Maxwell, it includes the retroactive guideline amendments that have been passed. In Montgomery, this court actually held that a district court's failure to calculate a non-retroactive guideline range after Maxwell was reversible error.
Yeah, but we have to follow Maxwell. That's the prior case.
That's true.
It says it's not a plenary resentencing, correct?
It does say that, but it still says that you have to actually take into account. Well, Judge Sutton in Jarvis said that in Maxwell they were talking about non-retroactive changes. So Maxwell actually doesn't speak to retroactive changes. And so far, everywhere, in every circuit, in every district, courts have at least taken into account the retroactive changes in the guidelines. So that's our position.
If we take into account the retroactive changes in the sentencing guidelines,
yes.
What is the sentencing guideline range that's appropriate here?
The aggregate sentencing guideline range today, including the retroactive changes to the crack range, is 160 to 185 months.
And if that were applied to Mr. Johnson, the district judge is authorizing continuation of the 300 months. And so the upward variance that's involved here is a huge percent.
It's quite large, yes. And I'd like to, if I may, point out that in deciding to leave intact that extreme upward variance, the district court relied entirely on Mr. Johnson's past conduct before he committed this offense, so it was 20 years ago, and didn't really fully weigh the fact that in the past 18 years he's been conducting himself in a way that indicates that he has lowered his risk of reoffending in the future and has not committed any violent offenses since he's been incarcerated and has worked very hard toward rehabilitating himself. If I may, in the briefing, I've covered several reasons why I think the sentence is procedurally and substantively unreasonable, based on the premise that the guideline range actually is 160 to 185 months because it is retroactively so. I'd like to focus, if I may, for just a few minutes on a couple of items that have emerged since the briefing was complete. The first one is the government's 28J letter regarding this court's
recent... I'd like to go back. I mean, I think the thrust of your argument is a lot of what you're arguing, but we've upheld this sentence twice already. And in the last time that this case was before us, I think Judge White's opinion, we considered the... We considered your client's conduct while incarcerated, and at least said there wasn't procedural. The sentence was procedurally reasonable, correct?
Well, actually, that was a 3582C2 appeal, which had to do with retroactive guideline amendment, which is limited by 1B1.110. So there's only a certain amount of room that the court can move. In any event, when the guideline range is limited under 1B1.10.
Yeah, we didn't move at all, though. I mean, we've actually looked at this twice, right? And I've upheld the 300 months twice, and the district court's done it three times.
But we sent it back to the district court again, right? Obviously, we wouldn't be here if we hadn't sent it back to the district court.
Right. So the reason why it's different this time, this is Mr. Johnson's position, it's different this time, is that the court is now in a position to be...
Did we send it back? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought this was a new...
It was sent back the very first time.
Right. But this was a new motion on the First Step Act is why we're here now, not because we remanded.
Exactly. I'm sorry.
If we tell you something wrong, please correct us.
I'm sorry about that. But the difference this time is that Judge Collier, in his denial of the motion, relied in part on information that was not fully explained to the court or apparently really apprehended by the court, which is...
This last time? So the most recent
the
time?
Pattern score. Yes. The judge relied on what I believe he was referring to and what the government was referring to and what's in the record is the BOP pattern score, which classifies Mr. Johnson as high risk. And that classification, though, was without any context. And when you actually go to look to see what that means in the pattern score publications that have come out, you discover that the cutoff for someone being deemed high risk in BOP is a 75% rate of reoffending, which is actually lower than what the guideline range of 160 to 185 months already accounts for. So his pattern score does not actually way in favor of finding that he presents a risk of violent reoffending such that a 10-year upward variance would be appropriate. So that's one of the things.
Well, I thought the upward variance was based on I have some notes here, but the pace of his crimes, that the severity of the crimes was increasing, that there was a lot of firearms and violence as part of his seven or eight pretty serious offenses in the past, and they didn't always account for the violence level the fact that a gun was carried. There were other factors the district court considered, and you're saying even though the district court considered all those, it's still an abuse of discretion for your client to be sentenced at this level.
It's an abuse of discretion when a district court bases its sentence on a fact or information that is actually really an assumption, and that's what happened here by relying on the BOP's risk assessment.
The things I just listed, those aren't assumptions, are they?
Those things, but those things that you just listed were back from before 2004. 20 years have passed. Mr. Johnson's been in prison. He's been taking courses.
That doesn't wipe out. I mean, it could. I mean, these are fair points. These could cut both ways. You could say, well, we should look at the current rather than the history. But the district judge gets a lot of leeway here. And by the way, your client had at least a drug offense while he's been in prison, so it hasn't been a totally clean card. Since he's been in prison, but why can't the district judge balance these things? Look at the prior offenses. Look at the conduct in prison.
Well, the judge can. The judge actually didn't look at his infractions while in prison because the government didn't present any evidence about it. So it would not be fair for us today to say that that's a reason why the district courts.
I know, but it counters your story that he said this perfect record.
Well, we don't know when that was. That could have been at the very beginning of his. We have no information about it. And the real point is that what we do know is that prisoners who actually engage in programming, which is a choice, they don't have to do it, and work have reduced their risk of reoffending. And he is not the same person as he was. I can see relying on some of those facts that the judge relied on back in 2006 and 2007 as reasons why maybe an upward variance might be appropriate. But what has happened is as the guideline range has gone down, we have come to the point as an agreement, as the commission and Congress and all of the ways that these guidelines get amended, we've come to a point where the guideline range, which this court otherwise says accounts for unwarranted disparity, is not being followed, and it's now a 10-year upward variance, which in Mr. Johnson's position is that does require more attention and closer review to decide whether the court has adequately explained why this upward variance is justified, given the amount of time that's passed since when he originally committed those offenses that you're talking about, which admittedly were not good. I'm not suggesting that those are offenses that, you know, we can tolerate, but we're in a different place. The First Step Act gives us the opportunity for a court to look to see whether what the court believed at the time the original sentence was imposed has borne out and has leeway to go anywhere on the sentencing scale. But why would we leave an upward variance of 10 years in this case, which many decisions of this court, precedential decisions before Himes was decided, Perez-Rodriguez, Boucher, Stock, have said that it's appropriate for this court to look at national data and say this case is an outlier and the judge
hasn't explained it. That's what Himes says?
What Himes says is that the district court is not required to look at this national sentencing data. It does not undo these precedential decisions that have looked at data to decide that a court didn't do a good enough job explaining
the
sentence.
It also says the guidelines themselves are supposed to incorporate that type of information.
They do for a guideline sentence, but this is not a guideline sentence. So this is distinguishable from Himes because Mr. Johnson got an extreme upward variance, whereas Mr. Himes got a sentence not only within the range, but once this court actually pulled the data that excluded the career offenders, which wasn't available at the time that Mr. Himes briefed his case, once this court did that, it was able to see that his sentence was really within the 40%, 50% range of what people get. So it's a different situation from this one where that same data that the court pulled shows that only a handful of people get upward variances who are crack offenders in criminal history category 6. A handful. So why should Mr. Johnson get the statutory maximum, which ordinarily this court has said in Aleo, for example, should be reserved for the worst of the worst.
Thank you.
Can I ask one quick thing? What was the point you were about to make about the 28J letter that you didn't get to?
I was speaking of the 28J letter that the government filed regarding this court's decision in Himes, and in particular the highlighting there of the line in Himes that talked about how even an above-range sentence is not going to be proven to be substantively unreasonable just because it's an above-average sentence. And what I was going to say is I agree with that. I think that's a very good point, and that Judge Quattlebaum in his dissent in Freeman makes an excellent point about how it is not helpful to look at an apple and compare it to the combination of apples, oranges, and bananas together. And what I was going to say is that the good news is since that decision came out, the Sentencing Commission has actually made available to the court a tool that would allow them to do what Judge Quattlebaum said that the majority should have done in that case, which is to actually go and look at the offense level and criminal history category for a crack offender in criminal history category 6, sentenced under 2D1.1, like Mr. Johnson, and can click a button and see what the average sentence is for that offender, which is more of a slice down that this court has said or suggested through implication would be a better way to compare. And when the court does that, I've done it, and I don't take my word for it, but when the court does that, you'll see that the average sentence for people in offense level 24, criminal history category 6, is the average sentence is 117 months. And that includes career offenders, and it includes 924Cs. So again, with that data, which is actually the data that Judge Quattlebaum said would be more useful, we know that Mr. Johnson's sentence is, in fact, an enormous upward variance and an outlier. And for that reason, the sentence, in his view, is substantively unreasonable.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Brian Samuelson and I represent the United States. When the district court imposed Johnson's sentence in 2009, it found that 300 months was the shortest sentence adequate to protect the public from future violent crimes. That finding was based on Johnson's criminal history and his age at the time, and the judgment that he needed to be confined into his 50s to protect the public. This court affirmed that finding and that sentence as reasonable. Now, the guidelines that would apply today have changed since then. But the reason for Johnson's sentence, namely the need to protect the public, has not changed. And the district court reasonably found that a 300-month sentence remained necessary to protect the public and to accomplish the goals of sentencing. Now, as a matter of procedural reasonableness, the district court considered everything it was supposed to consider. It considered the defendant's guidelines range. It considered the amended statutory penalties. It took a fresh look at the 3553A factors.
So considering the range, what is the range that is appropriate here in at the time of the motion that the district judge was deciding?
I believe under Maxwell says that in first step back motions, we should change exactly one variable, and that is the the changes to the statute that were made by the Fair Sentencing Act.
So, not the changes to the sentencing guidelines?
That's correct, Your Honor. And Johnson was sentenced in 2009. If the statutory changes to the Fair Sentencing Act had been in play then, his guideline range would not have changed. So I believe that the starting point was 200 to 235 months. Now, to be fair, Maxwell also says that the guidelines that would apply today are a factor that may be considered as part of the 3553A analysis. So the guidelines that apply today, the 160 to 185 months, are not irrelevant to the court's inquiry. But under Maxwell, I believe that the guidelines that apply for First Step Act purposes is 200 to 235 months.
And your opponent, I think, mentioned Montgomery. How does that affect this?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. For one, to the extent it conflicts with Maxwell, Maxwell must control. And two, Montgomery didn't directly address the issue of which guidelines range should apply. And I think Maxwell is clear here that we change exactly one variable, which is the statutory amendments made by the Fair Sentencing Act.
But as you said, Maxwell indicates that the sentencing guidelines today are factors, and so that's the 160 to 185 months. And so the situation we have is a sentence that is something like 62% increase over the highest number under the what would be current sentencing guidelines. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not quite sure about the precise math, but yes,
it's a huge increase. It's 300 months versus 160 to 185.
That's correct, Your Honor. Now, That disparity, though, is not an unwarranted disparity. There's no question that this sentence is above the guideline range. I mean, the guidelines tell us that this is a sentence that is longer than that received by many other defendants. But variations from the guidelines are justified where they're necessary to accomplish sentencing goals. And here the district court found that a 300-month sentence specifically was necessary to protect the public. And that was articulated in concrete terms based on the defendant's age at sentencing and his age at release and the relationship between age and recidivism. And that is the precise logic that this court affirmed in 2011 and 2012 as reasonable. And nothing about that logic has changed. It remains equally as valid today as it did in 2011 to 2012 when this court affirmed it.
There is this difference between what currently people believe on the Sentencing Commission believes is an appropriate sentence for a Category 6 person with these number of points, that 160 to 185 months is the appropriate sentence unless there are extraordinary factors that lead a district judge to say more.
Yes, Your Honor, and the guidelines that would apply today reflect a modern understanding of the severity of crack cocaine offenses. But the severity of the offense is just one sentencing factor. Other sentencing factor, it wasn't the sentencing factor that was the primary driver of the sentence in this case. The district court explained that this sentence is about the need to protect the public. And the variance above the guidelines range was justified by the need to keep this defendant confined into his early 50s.
So what makes his case different from the mine run of cases involving these particular crimes, the gun and drug crime?
There were several aspects of the criminal history that the district court found were not accounted for in the guidelines. This included the common presence of guns. The court listed, I think, 8 offenses that included the possession of guns. It included the pace of offending, the fact that arrests came within a few months of other arrests, that he seemed to be undeterred by previous sanctions. It included the escalating trajectory of the seriousness of the offense from merely possessing guns to using guns. And finally, of course, it included his age, that he was a relatively young man at sentencing and thus more likely to recidivate than when he will be released at 52.
And what is his age now?
I believe he's 48, Your Honor.
So he would be released at 52 if the 300 months applies, but if we were to say that this was not substantively reasonable and send it back, the earliest he could be released is his current age of 48?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that 4-year difference is important to the government, and that's why you're fighting this?
Well, it was important to Judge Collier, I take it.
Well, you were fighting it in front of Judge Collier, I assume.
Yes, Your Honor. The district
did you change your position here to be more stringent than you were in front of Judge Collier?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're being consistent in your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And Judge Collier, the district court, felt that 300 months remained necessary to protect the public.
And you were arguing for 300 months to remain the same, correct?
Yeah, the government opposed a reduction of the sentence below. That's correct.
And so now he's 48. Maybe he was 47 in front of Judge Collier, but you thought that those additional 5 years was important.
Well, Judge Collier explained when he originally imposed the sentence that sentence was necessary to protect the public.
So you're going back to the original rationale?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that original rationale retains its vitality. It is equally as valid today as it was in when it was imposed.
Now, the one factor that your opponent wants both Judge Collier and us to consider is rehabilitation in prison, and that is a factor that the Supreme Court has said can be considered.
Yes, Your Honor, and it could change the calculus here, and the district court considered whether it did. It acknowledged that he had participated in prison programming, that he had been accepted to the Second Chance program, and that he had supportive family members. It engaged in an explicit weighing. It said, that is commendable, but it does not outweigh the need to protect the public. So the district court...
Did we consider that factor also in 2017?
Rehabilitation?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, that that 2017 decision was based on the procedural reasonableness of the sentence, and this court found that it was procedurally reasonable. Yes, sir. So the district court considered all of the things it was supposed to consider. It simply did not weigh them in favor of a sentence reduction, and that was procedurally reasonable.
So will you address the substantive reasonableness point as well?
Yes, Your Honor. The substantive reasonableness point boils down to this. The district court found then and again when it reconsidered when it considered this sentence reduction motion that the defendant poses a serious risk of committing violent offenses. That finding was rooted in the analysis of the criminal history that we've discussed, the nature of his offenses, their pace, the escalating trajectory, and his age at release. The district court reasonably concluded that anything less than 300 months would be inadequate to protect the public from future violent crimes. And variances from the guideline are justified where they are necessary to accomplish a sentencing goal. And here that is the need to protect the public. This court found that that conclusion was reasonable in 2012, and nothing about that chain of logic, that this defendant is at risk of committing future violent crimes and that there is a need to protect the public with a 300-month sentence, nothing about that chain of reasoning has changed.
Was the 300-month sentence within the sentencing guideline range at the time it was imposed?
No, Your Honor. It was when it was imposed in 2009, it was above the guidelines range.
And what percent above it was it then?
The guideline range was 200 to 235 months, and this was a 300-month sentence. I wouldn't venture to do that math in my head, but it is
That's
substantially
okay.
above the guidelines range.
Mm-hmm. But this is more substantially above. But your basic point is not that much more.
My basic point is that the district court justified the 300-month sentence in concrete terms. When the district court imposed the sentence, it didn't impose this sentence because it was 65 months above the guideline range or 100 months above the guideline range. It imposed this sentence because it believed that it calculated 300 months was how long it would take for the defendant to age into his early 50s, which it calculated was when the risk to the public would be acceptable. And that calculation remains the same. In other words, the district court thought this sentence was necessary to protect the public from violent crime. That is a worthy sentencing goal and one that this court has affirmed before, and I urge you to affirm again. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the government didn't press the argument that the retroactive guideline amendments are not to be considered as part of the amended guideline calculation until today. That was the first time that this has happened in this case and in any other case that I'm aware of. I think at this point it's important to point out, based on our discussion, really in light of our discussion, Judge Radler, about Maxwell and what it holds, is that the Supreme Court granted cert in a case, United States versus Concepcion, out of the Second Circuit. And in that case, the question presented is whether the district court, in deciding a First Step Act motion under Section 404, must or may take into account intervening changes in the law. The briefing is underway, and Maxwell is being held pending the outcome in Concepcion. So it could be that the Supreme Court is going to tell us more about exactly what the district court must or may do.
So should we hold this case until the Supreme Court rules on that other matter?
I'm not asking the court to hold this case in waiting for that, largely because the government has not before actually taken the official position that the guideline range is not changed by retroactive amendments. That's a new thing. So if this court is at all inclined to think that retroactive changes are not part of the amended guideline range, then yes, I would ask the court to hold for the outcome in Concepcion. My reason for this is that it does appear, or it has appeared, at least in the discussions that have happened after Maxwell in Montgomery and in Jarvis that at least retroactive changes are treated as being part of the amended guideline range. And that makes sense because a retroactive guideline amendment means that that's what the guideline should have been back at the time that the original sentence was imposed. The second thing I'd like to say is at the time that the district court imposed the 300-month sentence, it was a 28% upward variance. Now it's significantly greater than that, and also the statutory maximum. The law is that the greater the variance, the more compelling the justification has to be. And this court, in many decisions, has said that when you're deciding whether the justification is sufficiently compelling, it looks to see whether the sentence is an outlier, whether there's a danger or threat of unwarranted disparities by a statutory maximum sentence. That's what the court said in Aleo, and that's what Mr. Johnson asked the court to do today. And with that, I just want to sort of close by saying that Mr. Johnson, while he did actually conduct himself in ways that involved firearms and violent conduct back before he committed this offense, the fact that he's managed to make it 18 years in prison without having engaged in any violent conduct is meaningful and should be taken into account. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your argument. The case will be, the case will be submitted, and the clerk may call the next case.